How does a United States Air Force officer end up leading a European biotech company? Is there an advantage to leading a company that's based half a world away? And are you doing a regrets analysis as part of your decision making? Maybe you should be. I know I will from now on. Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys of life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. I'm joined by Mark Gaffney, a Boston-based CEO leading Kiluna Pharma. Kiluna is a Norwegian company developing therapeutics for inflammatory and fibrotic diseases such as IPF, but we'll get into the science a bit later in the episode. Mark, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, David.
You have an impressive background. You are the CEO of Kiluna Pharma, as you mentioned. You're based in Norway, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, you said a European, this is the view from the States, I think, just European biotech.
Sure.
We're all just one country. But you're Norwegian based, but you were the ex-CEO of Oxular, right?
Correct. That's a UK based biotech that was sold to Regeneron at the end of 2024.
Nice. And you've been in the C-suite at Videre Bio, and you've been at Ironwood Pharmaceuticals in, it was co-head VP corporate development. So that's an impressive list. But before all that, you were an officer in the United States Air Force. So tell me, how does a USAF officer find themselves in the life science sector?
So David, it's like many people you probably speak with, not a very typical or linear journey. I think it goes all the way back to living my life as a kid when my dad got diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa. So Retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, is a degenerative eye disease where he progressively was losing his peripheral vision over time. And I found it, even as a teenager, incredibly frustrating and surprising that, as you see a lot of medical innovation happening on a number of domains, I felt like there's very limited improvements on treating blind patients. I mean, blindness shows up in the Bible. We've known about this for thousands and thousands of years. And I felt like there's just a lack of progress in that space. And I just knew that there's so much more out there in patients who have needs, who have meaningful impact. I mean, losing your vision has such an impact on so many dimensions of your life and your family's life that I've wanted to be a part of that and contribute to that in some way. And to your point, it wasn't linear. It didn't start going right into science out of high school. It took a bit of a diversion, but it was important to, and it was underlying a lot of my interest in ultimately getting into this space.
I can't imagine what it was like growing up with a parent suffering from something like retinitis pigmentosa. That, and you mentioned that it was occurring while you were a teenager as well. So that's very like formative years. When you moved into the life science sector, did you go immediately for treatments in that area?
I didn't, actually. My inroads into the industry were after my military career. I went into law as my first post-military practice, and I had the opportunity working for a large law firm in the Boston area to work with a bunch of life science clients, and in particular, a company you mentioned, Ironwood Pharmaceuticals, in 2010 was in the middle of going public, which, if you remember back then, we're coming out of the financial crisis. Biotech, technology, everything in the entire macro economy was in a tough position. But Ironwood was fortunate because they had persistently and progressively advanced their lead program, which at that point was completing phase 3 development in gastrointestinal disorders, actually. And they had aspirations of taking this and using that as a linchpin to form a large, fully integrated biopharmaceutical company, and had the opportunity with incredibly impressive clinical data to take that company public and use that as the linchpin for a strategy that evolved over my 10-year career there. So after spending a few years as a lawyer, which was an extension of my, frankly, engineering degree and military background, a kind of much more structured practice, I realized that I wanted to get closer and closer and closer to the ultimate strategy and decision-making at an organization, because I realized over that accrual, over those different experiences, I felt like I had a lot to offer in that space, and I still had that underlying personal conviction about participating directly in helping patients in a number of ways. I was fortunate to be able to have a chance to work on blindness. In fact, specifically my dad's form of blindness when I jumped over to Videre Bio in early 2020. And in particular, Videre, the technology we were taking forward was an optogenetic approach to restoring vision in patients. So my dad was kind of the ideal demographic, someone who'd been substantially progressed, And so just slowing the decline wasn't of real value to them, but actually trying to restore vision in these patients so they could regain a lot of functionality they didn't, they had lost, you know, years, sometimes decades in life. And we were able to take that technology forward and ultimately sold it to Novartis, who took the non-clinical and clinical development forward on their into their pipeline, which I think is the best option for that program in the early 2020s.
Now, you were quite high up in Videre. You were COO or CBO or both, possibly?
Both, correct.
Yep. So that takes us to Videre. Tell me, what was it that inspired you to step up to lead?
Sure. Well, a few things. One is, as I mentioned, this continued progression towards the kind of the strategy and decision-making at the company. And I had an opportunity at Videre as COO and CBO to be hand-in-hand, close partnership with our CEO in the execution of that strategy. And when we sold Videre, and then ultimately we formed another company trying to even make better vision improvements for those patients, unfortunately, that science wasn't reproducible. So we ended up winding that operation down. I was thinking about what to do next. And Forbion is the large investor, and Oxular approached me, given my experience in ophthalmology, about a potential CEO role. And admittedly, David, I was reluctant. I never thought I would be in a position to be a CEO of a biotech, given my lack of a scientific background in biology or chemistry or an MD. I was trained as a mechanical engineer. I was a military officer. I was a lawyer. And I'll never forget the advice that my CEO at Videre told me, which was, you're as unready for that role as I was for my first time CEO role. And giving me that boost and that confidence and saying, you bring skills to the table that you may not appreciate that others who may have a more traditional path don't, gave me the confidence to take that jump in 2024. So I had the chance to join Oxular. As I mentioned, it was a relatively short career there because we quickly pivoted the company strategy and put it in a position to be sold, which is really enabling the use of its crown technology, which is a delivery technology to the back of the eye, and getting it in the hands of a pharmaceutical company who had a platform of programs that it can use that technology for. Whereas at Oxford, we were very limited in how we could interrogate it. So it's the kind of appreciation for the skills I developed earlier in my career and bring them to the forefront. And then that additional boost of confidence I got from that support and endorsement from my CEO colleague at Videre, which really gave me the confidence to move ahead.
Yeah. And your background, again, so interesting, so diverse. Being able to take that into a leadership position, you clearly sounds like an asset. But were there any personal challenges you faced along the way? And how much did your Air Force background help or hinder you in that process?
You know, it's funny you say that. It was, I think back to my first experience as a 22-year-old lieutenant who just graduated from college. My first assignment was working for a ground station that was in Virginia, collecting signals that were being transported over satellite, being gathered over southern Iraq after the Iraqi war had come to an end, and we were monitoring the southern no-fly zone. And I show up, and I'm, as I mentioned, young lieutenant overseeing a group of 85 analysts and specialists, ranging from people who are 19 years old to people who had been in the Air Force at that point for over 30 years. And you're put in charge. And this is a, you know, relatively typical military construct where, you, number one, the first thing you quickly realize is you really don't know anything about the mission of that company or that organization or that unit. Number two, if you don't surround yourself and trust the right people, you are going to set yourself up for failure, guaranteed failure. And number three, the only way to figure out number one and number two are ask questions. And that humility you quickly learn. And then number two, learning to grow through interrogation and actual curious interrogation was essential. And I find myself as a CEO drawing on those experiences and lessons, you know, now well over 25 years ago, and pulling that thread through and probably appreciating I was actually doing that along the way more than I realized, but certainly as a CEO doing that on a daily basis. That is absolutely critical. And I do think that differentiates me from other CEOs who don't have a similar leadership training or background and maybe more scientifically inclined. The key was surrounding ourselves at Kelowna with the people who do augment in those critical areas to advancing what's obviously very complicated science in our space, and having the luxury of being able to do that with an incredible team here at Kelowna.
I think that story, it's funny because I'm in the privileged position of being able to speak to so many CEOs, but also founders with sure. Life Science Org and NextGen. It's so funny how your story parallels the scientific founder. They suddenly go from academia, you know, education, and they find themselves at the head of a company, and they're not necessarily out of their depth, but certainly in a completely new situation. And like you said, being able to surround yourself with the right people, ask the right questions is the most, I think, useful way to handle that. Do you see any other parallels with your peers in life science in terms of this aspect of leadership?
With my peers, certainly, you know, others who have been in, whether they're self-induced or challenging situations, either personal experiences or, you know, people who've had certain careers that are tangential to our industry, you know, either athletes or in business, or even, frankly, in many cases, academia. But to your point, when you start to unpack these and you read more leadership books and you learn from more mentors, you realize at the core, the essence of this is really about being a career learner and always looking to learn from what your peers have done, both right and wrong, but then asking questions of your team and being curious, because number one, it gets the best out of your team. Two, you get smarter along the way. And three, by knowing that they're accountable to you and asking these questions, people will bring their A game. And I find the other people who've succeeded in the space kind of bring that same mindset, pulling from other, you know, from their own experiences. I think the ones where they ultimately fail, and whether it's sometimes short, mid, or long term, is where their ego gets in front of them and they don't have the ability to see through that. And they see it as a weakness if they don't come up with all the answers. They see it as a perceived shortcoming that how does the CEO not know this? And they've put too much on their own shoulders, frankly, and that often can be a derailer for them.
Mark, you're in the unenviable position of leading a company that is across an ocean and about half of a continent. It's a tricky situation to be in, to be the kind of leader as well that, as you seem to be, relying on communication, asking those questions, and surrounding yourself with the right people. How do you lead the company effectively from so far away?
It's funny you use the adjective unenviable. I actually find it, now having done it twice between Oxford and here, a quite enviable position. I think there's a few things. You know, first, there's a very logistical one. I'm a morning person, and with most of my team being 5 or 6 hours ahead of me, I'm able to kind of harness what I think is my sharpest hours of the day to have those meetings and collaborative interactions. And then for the afternoon, which often can be my lull, having my time to process my own thoughts and get organized and then also be prepared for the next day. So I found it to be very actually efficient in that way. The second is, you know, a lot of people attribute virtual leadership in companies really to this pivotal point post the pandemic. And actually, you know, if you take a step back and look, a lot of organizations, the military being probably the most long-running one, have been leading in, or you've been in leadership situations where you lead virtually for decades and centuries at this point. And going back to that first assignment I talked about in the Air Force, I was the ground station commander on any given mission in communicating directly with a pilot who's flying over southern Iraq at 60,000 feet, you know, 8 hours ahead and 1,000 miles away. And if we're not harmonized here, you know, obviously that's not going to be an effective mission. No, by the way, the data we're creating now has to be reported to that air operations center, which is in the same jurisdiction as he or she is. And so something I've just been kind of acclimated to since my career almost 30 years ago now. And what you realize is, number one, you have to be very intentional and thoughtful because you have these limited personal interactions about how you communicate, what you communicate, and when you communicate. But then also realizing, when is this too complicated? When is it much more efficient to do this face-to-face? When do I get on a plane? When do you get on a plane? When do we figure out a place to meet in person? And where is that really going to get the best out of the situation? And over, you know, decades of doing this, you realize which situations rise to that level and which can be navigated on their own. And I will say one of the strengths is it forces the team and individuals on the team to think through and actually be more willing to try and figure things out on their own. And knowing where does that limit go too far and not operate in isolation, but actually maybe before I jump in and walk down the hall and ask a question, let me think about this and try and figure out some more of this on my own. And I think with the, you know, experienced team that we have at Kaluna, it's really played out. And the perfect example is right now our lead program in its phase 2 study is enrolling substantially ahead of projections because the team jumped into problem solving mode right out of the gates and has done an incredible job at working closely with all the different constituents in running a clinical trial to make it happen. But they don't have someone standing over their shoulder breathing down their neck. They had to get very clever very quickly. And now we've become essentially, you know, a virtual operation because so many people are engaging personally with their sites and moving all across, not just the continent of Europe, but frankly, all over the world.
Wow, that's amazing to hear. And it kind of leads me on to the next thing I'd like to ask you about, which is on learning. You know, we're big on learning in life science org. We have our monthly or bi-monthly meetings, expert talks. I'd love to know, what lesson have you learned from a colleague or a peer that no formal education could have taught you? And I love as well that, and just harking back to what you said earlier, that you had a CEO, a mentor who gave you that initial push. Were there any other stories from that you can share?
Sure. When someone believes in you or sees something in you, you don't see in yourself, which I think we all have these blind spots about ourselves. And sometimes it's humility. Sometimes it's lack of confidence. Sometimes it's just self-awareness. But someone who sees that in you and is able to pull that out and have you realize it on your own is critical. I think the other one I brought back, you know, to my military experience, which is learning quickly about how to lead, especially groups who have a lot more experience, a lot more knowledge than you do, and how you can be an effective leader and actually an asset to them and not a disabler. I think the third one, I go back to my biotech experience. The first COO at Ironwood, who I worked with and has become a lifelong mentor to me, is always running that regrets analysis. When you're going through that decision-making in your head or as a group and ultimately coming up upon what you think is the right conclusion, I think what gave me the confidence to going from an advisor role, such as a lawyer, to a decision-making role, such as a CEO, is doing that last piece, is what the regret. What's the regrets analysis? If we do this, what do we regret? Let's put ourselves forward when this is materialized or not materialized, what do we regret doing? And layering that piece in, which often can be forgotten. You can often get caught up in your decisions that you make and kind of think about what's the most optimistic path, but they maybe, what if that doesn't quite play out as we expect? And we hit this in a number of occasions as Ironwood was growing from a single asset company into a whole portfolio of commercial products between equity fundraising, fundraising of other types of capital, and also business development transactions. And always asking ourselves that, because you know, the people who you talk with, your board of directors and your investors are absolutely thinking that. So that brings you very well prepared into those conversations and also really gives you that confidence about making those decisions. And I find myself pulling that into my life on a daily basis.
I think that's a lovely concept, this regrets analysis. Can you expand on that a little bit, as if teaching our audience what this is and how you do that from a very fundamental level, because this is the first I've heard of it.
Sure. So, you know, I think the premise is quite simple. Well, you know, you've got a decision you're going to recommend going ahead with. Now let's put ourselves forward, whatever the time domain is to when that decision is going to have impact. And what do we regret about that decision? And you look back, okay, and assuming either, you know, things play out that are foreseeable and you can always pull in stuff that's completely out of your control. That's irrelevant and useless. But things that we can control, what do we regret about making this decision? And if you ultimately, then when you weigh that into the considerations and say, okay, when you put those into the mix and you weigh those against what we could gain from it, are you still happy with the decision you made? Because no decision's going to be perfect. No decision's going to play out exactly as you expect. And that's really the kind of the true test, because you can often, although it sounds quite simple in concept, it often can be forgotten when you get the momentum going towards heading in a certain direction. And many times you realize sometimes the regret is quite significant, in which case let's go back and choose a different decision, or it's actually not that significant and that's fixable this way or that way. So this is the right way to go because there's so many unknowns that we can't control. This is the best we can do with this, the information we've got.
It sounds like a very useful way of approaching decision-making. I hear so many CEOs complaining is not the right word, discussing decision-making on a very almost academic level, because it's so important for a CEO to make decisions.
It absolutely is. And that's the other thing. You have to be comfortable making it. If you're not, you shouldn't be in the seat. And I say that not in the form of a dictatorship, by all means, getting the team involved and coming along and being part of the journey. And ultimately, you're often representing what the group recommends, but being comfortable making those decisions and living with the consequences of those decisions, which I think a lot of people underestimate in our when you get to the CEO role, and being comfortable. And if you've surrounded yourself with the right board of directors and investors and team, then, and you communicated that very clearly well to them and what decision you make, why you made it, what you could have made and why you chose not to make it. I think you have the right people and they'll have your support. And that's how we navigate this industry, which absolutely, you know, if you can't work through that, the science and the biology are challenging enough. You're definitely going to be in a tough spot.
We haven't even got to the science bit. Before we talk about Kaluna, tell me what, because you have a unique perspective sitting in Boston, surrounded by biotech. maybe less so than a couple of years ago. But what do you find particularly exciting or inspiring about European life science today?
It's a great question, David, and I should have touched on earlier. It is a real asset, I think, having someone on this side of the pond when it comes to fundraising and business development, for sure. What I find particularly interesting about European life science is the efficiency, but yet the kind of scientific curiosity that still applies there. And what I mean by that is, here at Kelluna, we're working on two novel targets that we have, like I mentioned, one in the clinic, one approaching development candidate in immunology and fibrotic disorders. Over the last 4 years, you know, I think there's a lot of companies who were the novel target or novel modality approaches got sidelined because everyone wanted reduced risk. And so if you're still existing today in 2026 and have survived those last few years, you've got clearly a high bar that you've achieved in whatever package you've generated to still be funded and moving ahead. And all of our science comes out of Europe. And I think the reason we were able to do that is because, one, there's a persistence and insistence on continuing to do that in the face of headwinds over people looking for improvements on validated targets. And two, the depth and efficient way they were able to interrogate that non-clinically in order to get us the approach to moving in the clinic, or to get us the approval to move in the clinic. And I contrast that, you know, a bit. You know, we often hear about how important and critical and expeditious things are in China. And I'm not going to in any way represent that. I feel like Europe is operating as quickly as they are in China. Different conversation about whether which approach is right, but I find it to be in a very efficient ecosystem over there, a very well-connected ecosystem, and one that's willing to take appropriate risks and not be hamstrung by, you know, looking for clinically validated targets only. And I know Kelluna is one of several enterprises who continue to fight towards driving true innovation for these patients, because that's ultimately what a lot of them continue to need.
Going on from that with Kelluna, what you're looking at now, tell me about the challenge that you are facing and what it means for patients. Sure. And of course, why you have chosen to pursue this as a leader.
Sure. So the challenge we're facing is we are right now interrogating our antibody going after a novel upstream innate immunity target called S100A4. And we're interrogating it in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, or IPF. IPF, for those who are familiar with it, has been a persistent, relatively large orphan disease that continues to face clinical setback after clinical setback. There are three approved drugs right now, all of which do certainly improve these patients' lung function, which is ultimately will, from diagnosis within 10 years, have a very high cause of mortality. But yet, despite that, still a substantial number of these patients are coming off drug because it's so intolerable. And, you know, when you take a step back and think about cheese, you know, because of the disease you have, you're going to die somewhere in the 5 to 10 year window. But there's a treatment out there that could extend that. But it's so intolerable, you're willing to forego that treatment entirely, just is a testament to the demand that still exists. And yes, there are ways to take the targets of those drugs and make improvements and hopefully reduce the tolerability. And I'm thrilled there are companies that are doing that, because that's an absolutely first step in innovating and improving for these patients. However, it's idiopathic in nature, as we know by its name. There's a lot of causes here. There's a lot of work to be done to actually get these patients to continue to have improved lung, or to keep that lung function as long as they can, and frankly, possibly even improve that lung function. And so what we're trying to do at Kelluna is move that target that you go after much further upstream that could impact a number of these inflammatory and fibrotic cascades. That's not been an easy story or well-received story in the last few years, not because of the science isn't there, but just the risk that comes with that. And I think, as I mentioned, you know, the last few years, a lot of pressure we get from prospective investors and potential partners is, show me the clinical validation. Of course, they know we don't have it. It's novel by definition, but call me back when you do have it. And so who's going to stand behind us? Who's going to say, we're willing to take that shot with you? You have to show up with an incredibly strong preclinical package. You have to show up with a very clear and conviction that you're able to run it on a budget that you put in front of those investors, because they don't want to keep throwing good money after this, especially given the novelty of it. And I think, so we faced an execution challenge. We've faced a risk tolerance challenge that we've endured over the last few years. And I'm happy to report are now well enrolled into our phase two clinical study, and hope to have and expect to have data in next year for that, in 2027.
It's wonderful to hear, especially you've articulated the challenges, I think, so clearly, not just from like the investor point of view, but also that kind of scientific challenge and the challenges for patients. I mean, it is heartbreaking that the only drug out there is so intolerable. And IPF, for people who don't know, is a horrific illness. It is absolutely horrific, and it's heartbreaking to see a loved one go through it.
Sure.
My follow-up question for you on this, and it kind of extends from some of the seeds you just planted there. What can we do in the ecosystem to help address the challenge of IPF and research into kind of anti-inflammatory diseases more generally? The we here, I'm referring to maybe beyond your team, scientists in Europe, investors, pharma companies, regulators, and others in the broader ecosystem. What would you like to see to help face that challenge?
Sure. I'd say keep the resilience and persistence. You know, I think that's one of the underlying strengths of this team. We've been locked arm in arm for the last few years navigating this challenging environment. I think all of us have a bit of a sadistic side of ourselves where we like to take on difficult challenges. You know, there's been opportunities to do other things that are less risky, but also less impactful, and keep pushing through this. You know, all challenges are temporary in nature, and we're already starting to see an uptick in the financial environment, certainly from a regulatory standpoint. There's a lot of variability, but that too will subside over time, and keep pushing and challenging convention and conventional wisdom, and think about ways that could actually have a really breakthrough impact. And if you run the right studies, and by the way, you may not know what the right studies are, so go back to the first comment I made, ask those questions. Don't be afraid to ask people who have experience in this space or may not. They want to help, because all of us are in this industry because we want to help patients. They want to share the learnings. They want to tell you this model is particularly good and this model is not. This model, you know, this assay is the way to validate it. This one is less valuable to us. You know, always ask those questions, but then go figure out what needs to be done and put together a well-thought-through business plan. And there will be support for that. You will get the support. I think there is, despite any of the differences that we have now across the globe, I think there's an underlying goal, which is to find transformative improvements for patients across, and IPF is one of several indications that fall in that category. Keep up the fight, and don't be afraid to ask the questions about what does it take to get there. They're not dumb questions. They're definitely ones that we're all facing, and don't repeat someone else's mistakes. If you just asked the right question, you would have been able to avoid, because you're going to have your own as an enterprise and as an individual.
Like the underlying sentiment of all that is just don't give up, which
exactly
I
exactly
think is core for everybody in the ecosystem, especially for such challenging illnesses like IPF.
Right.
The last thing I would like to do with our podcast, Mark, is, and first of all, I want to thank you for sharing some wonderful stories with me and for your time. I know how busy you are as a CEO, but I'd like to ask you, is there anything on the leadership journey or leadership, even as a concept, that we haven't talked about that has been rattling around your head that you would like to discuss?
A leader is only as good as his or her team. And frankly, a leader is better when she or he has an incredible team. And you are the spokesperson for your organization. You are the chief risk officer, and you're also the chief strategist for sure. That can't get to your head, though, because all of the development of the underlying messages and the strategy and the risks, the execution really happens in the organization. And that comes on two dimensions. One is identifying people who are incredibly capable and effective and harnessing that and getting every ounce of that out of them and seeing stuff in them that they don't see in themselves, because that's how you got to where you are. But then when you realize that you don't have that person, isn't the right fit for your organization, and that's no shortcoming on an individual's capabilities, but not everyone is a perfect fit for every organization, obviously. Doing right by that person and doing right by your organization and making decisions quickly and swiftly and getting the right people in there. Don't be afraid to do that. Your investors see it. Your team sees it. That person, frankly, often sees it. Get that, make those changes that you need to make and move ahead and do the regrets analysis on the other side of it. And certainly you have to keep that in mind, but don't be afraid to make those decisions. I oftentimes ask myself, well, boy, if we make this decision, what does that mean for longevity if this asset doesn't work? What does that mean for our longevity? It's a very understanding and appreciative industry. If you have the confidence and make those decisions the right way, more will follow. Because if this asset doesn't work, let's all move on and find something else. And there's plenty of something else out there to work on. So I'd say the only other points I'd say is don't be afraid to be decisive in recognizing the good and the bad. And then when you surround yourself with a great team, your success is going to depend on that.
I can certainly see that aspect of encouraging your team, encouraging others around you in yourself. Because for the listeners, before we started recording, Mark complimented my podcast voice, which I immediately, played down. And he encouraged me to do more with it.
Absolutely. To keep doing what you're great at, right? And, dude, you're an incredibly hot podcast host. Keep doing more of this.
In everything, Mark, you're a wonderful CEO, wonderful leader, and a wonderful person. Thank you so much for joining me today, and hopefully your lessons will resonate across our community of life science leaders.
Thanks for having me, David. Happy to speak with you and look forward to seeing how the whole industry progresses over this important 2026.
It's no secret that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions, inspire us every week. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our life science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.